You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot going on. Connecticut is preparing to pass the strictest gun laws in the country. Matt Drudge is hysterical about it. And the UN is actually proposing a treaty. This would be one of a, you know, following a long train of them that regulates weapons, you know, tanks and assault vehicles, the sale of weapons of war, basically. But deep down inside, according to the Washington Times, deep down inside, the language is a reference to small arms that might just mean that the UN is going to come and get your gun. No, not really. I mean, that's what they're saying, but that's not really. The day that, you know, UN troops show up in the United States with blue helmets and go to, it's the day it's all over. But it will be really effective fundraising for Wayne LaPierre, or Wayne LaPetite, as I prefer to. By the way, it just, we were talking before the show, and it suddenly hit me. Pierre is the French way of saying Peter, right? Isn't Peter and Pierre, aren't they the same thing? I think so. And La in French is the. So his name is Wayne the Peter? Really? In any case, Wayne LaPetite and you know, the NRA will no doubt be raising money on this one. I can, you know, if it's the screaming top of Drudge. Meanwhile, the governor in Connecticut, Daniel Malloy, is concerned because while they're banning high-capacity clips going forward, they're saying that high-capacity clips that you already own, no problem. Okay, so that's happening. In Screwed News, Stockton, California is broke. This the city has gone broke. Very interesting, though, the way that they're doing it. They're basically ripping off people's pensions. Not a good thing. So we'll see how that shakes out. We have now officially passed green energy. Renewable energy has officially passed nuclear power in the United States as a source of energy for our nation. I think that's a big deal. And the Eurozone broke another unemployment record in the first 2 months of this year. The overall rate in the entire European bloc is 12%. What's happening here in the Eurozone is the same thing that happens when you're on the gold standard. And that is that you, is that a country that is, and this is why we ditched the gold standard in 1944 when we signed Bretton Woods. I realize that, you know, we closed the gold window in 71. Nixon did that. But really, the gold standard arguably died in 44 with the Bretton Woods agreement because the United States became the currency against which 44 of the currencies were measured. But prior to that, here's the problem that you have with the gold standard, and it's the exact same problem that the European Union countries have being on the euro, and that is that you lose the flexibility to basically stretch things. You know, when the economy falls, when capitalism fails, when the business cycle goes negative, that's the time that government should kick up spending. They should borrow money and spend money to fill in the holes of the business cycle so that we don't go into a demand spiral or a loss of demand spiral so that the economy doesn't crash. But if you're on a gold standard, you know, the rules of the gold standard used to be that countries that had, you know, as they produced more money relative to the amount of gold, they also had to raise interest rates because, you know, for the same reason that right now the European countries like Spain and Italy and Greece, as their ability to pay back loans, because they're on the euro standard and they only have a certain number of euros, just like countries only had a certain amount of gold, they're having to borrow money. Their ability to pay it back in euros that actually they have is diminished, and so their interest rates go up. Similarly, if you don't have a lot of gold, your interest rates go up. Well, from 1927 to 1933, France cornered the world's gold market. They went from 7% of the world's gold market to 23 or 25% of the world's gold market. And there are some who are arguing that that's what caused the Great Depression. Now, I don't buy that, but I think that that's what, one of the things that prevented us from getting out of it, because France did not monetize that gold. They did not then produce French francs and say, okay, and now we can spend our way out of the Depression. Instead, they just basically hoarded it. And we did the same thing here in the United States with the gold that we had. This is why a gold standard is a bad idea, because it inhibits your ability to be flexible and respond to recessions, and thus turns recessions into depressions. And it's the exact same thing that Republicans are trying to do legislatively by saying austerity. If you have a recession, you do austerity. Well, that's the opposite of what you should be doing, and history tells us that over and over and over again, but that's what the Europeans are doing. Now, I have a question for you. Are you your politics? We had a interesting conversation recently with a friend who is, she's just like totally all about politics. And lives in a very conservative area and wants to, and but is a very, you know, outspoken progressive and wants to make a difference and is constantly trying to convert conservatives to being a progressive. And I, you know, Louise and I kind of got it from talking with her that she thinks that she is her politics. You know, couldn't get over being angry at Obama for not being the FDR that he could have been. Couldn't get over, you know, the upsets about, you know, Bradley Manning and the drones and all these other things. Now, I'm upset about all those things. And I talk about politics every day on the radio. I do this for a living, but long before I did it for a living, I've been political my whole entire life. Well, at least since I was 12, when my dad first took me to a John Birch Society meeting and a Republican meeting, and I read John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason and suddenly realized that the State Department was full of communists. And, you know, I've always viewed politics as really a sacred thing, as something that we do to change the country. But what I know is that I am not my politics. I am me. I remember when I was 15 or 16 years old reading P.D. Ouspensky. And I'm doing this from memory. It's been, a long time since I read these books. So if I get something wrong, if there's Ouspensky fans out there and I offend you, my apologies. Feel free to call in and correct me. But my recollection is I read three of his books, In Search of the Miraculous, Deuterium Organatum, or words to that effect. I'm not sure I ever learned how to correctly pronounce it. And The Fourth Way, as I recall. And basically what Ouspensky said, he had been a student of Gurdjieff's for 10 years. These guys were both Russians, and Gurdjieff was a Russian mystic. And Ouspensky was writing in the 40s and 50s, and they hung out back in the 19-teens and thereabouts. In fact, a fellow by the name of Thomas de Hartmann, spelled with two N's, the musician, did a bunch of music based on his time with Gurdjieff, which I have on my iPhone. I listen to it on airplanes and things. Piano music, beautiful music. But anyhow, what he did was, his meditation technique, as it were, was to notice what's going on inside your own head. It's almost like sitting in a little chair back behind your head and going, oh, look at that. He's getting all upset about that. Oh, look at that. He wants that. Oh, look at that. He doesn't like that. Oh, look at that. He thinks this is important. And just noticing, oh, look at that, he feels a certain way. You know, just noticing what's going on with yourself. And it creates a certain separateness that allows, or objectivity, I guess would be the word, that allows you to know for certain that you are not your politics. And I think it's one of the things, I've done it pretty much all my life, and I think it's one of the things that allows me to get into a political debate with somebody and not hate them after. So how do you deal with this? How do you debate politics?
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Do you struggle with thinking that you are your politics as opposed to you are something else? And what's your story about who you are? So I first started noticing this what I'm describing to you, what I learned from P.D. Ouspensky back when I was 16, 17 years old, and have been practicing in various forms throughout my life, he called it the difference between being conscious and being aware, if I recall correctly. And again, if you're an Ouspensky fan, give me a call and correct me if I've got any of this wrong. I have not kept up with it over the years. I know there's Gurdjieff groups all over the country. They tend to be, you know, not evangelical. You've got to look for them. But in any case, my recollection is that he basically said that, you know, like looking out at the world is awareness. Seeing the color of the sky, feeling the temperature of the air, whatever, all that, that's all awareness. But that's not consciousness. The consciousness is being aware of yourself being aware. In other words, being aware of your own awareness. That's consciousness. And when Louise and I lived in Atlanta, we used to go to the Atlanta Soto Zen Center and every Sunday. And in fact, with a couple of our kids like to go with us, too. And just, you know, just sit for an hour on a little futon, on a little Zabu and Zabudan, or however they say them, these little futons that up against a stone wall. And I just sit there looking at the stone, you know, looking down about the angle of my nose for an hour. And like, oh, and every thought that comes up, just say, oh, look at that thought and let go of it. Oh, there's another thought. Oh, and let go of it. Because it's so easy to get into, you know, get caught on a thought train and just, it just drags you down. Oh, wow, you know, and then if I did this. And then 3 minutes later, you realize, wow, I just started that thought train with thinking about, the, you know, this, and that led to that, and that led to that. You know, but, so, anyway, it's I find it interesting. And now we're seeing all these studies on mindfulness training. Mindfulness has become the new thing. Vipassana, if you want to use the religious version of it, mindfulness, the secular version. And, you know, it's basically the same thing. It's sitting and being aware of your awareness. And they're finding that people who just spend 10, 15 minutes a day being mindful, noticing that you're noticing, that they get wildly better results in life. Their memory works better. Their test scores improve. Their emotional, mental and emotional health improves. I mean, there's a lot of amazing stuff. R, is your name R? In Alpha.
That's me.
Say what?
That's me.
Okay, in Alpha, Florida. You're listening on Sirius. Hey, thanks for calling. You want to talk about Ouspensky?
Yeah, I was turned on Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, a thing called self-remembering comes to mind.
Uh-huh, yes.
And Gurdjieff looked at himself as being an esoteric Christian, looking at Christ's teachings from the inside out, not how normal religion teaches it. He was an amazing dude, and it changed, reading those books changed my life. It kept me from committing suicide after I got beat out of a lot of money down in South Florida.
Wow.
I mean, I can't say enough about it. And everybody should read it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You dig?
I do.
I got sick. I was May 4th. I was at Kent State. My girlfriend was shot at May 4th, 1970.
Oh,
hey,
wow.
I'm breaking up too, and I'll talk to you. Bye.
Okay. Thanks a lot, R. Wow. That's a tough one. Yeah, Gurdjieff's writings were really tough. He wrote a book called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson that my kids gave to me for Christmas 20 years ago or so. And I couldn't read it. It was too complex and confusing. And, you know, but Ouspensky translated it into English or translated it into whatever language he was writing in, maybe Russian. But in English, I could read Ouspensky and understand it. But even beyond that, I mean, you know, not getting into Ouspensky and Gurdjieff, but this whole idea of there are so many people I know who I run across, particularly, you know, I go out and do public events and, you know, here's the guy who talks about politics, Tom Hartman, and you meet somebody and they're just so passionate, and which is wonderful. But some of them, you get to know these folks a little bit better and you discover they don't have an off switch. And so they end up alienating their friends, alienating their families. And they've lost contact with the idea that I am not my politics. I have my politics, but I am not my politics. I have my opinions, but I am not my opinions. I am something bigger than that, or deeper than that, or smaller than that, more subtle than that. There's 100,000 ways to describe it, no doubt. But I think the essential, and this is the point that's so important. I have a friend who is a really, really, really brilliant psychotherapist. His name is Hillel, or Hilly. And Hilly once told me that when he starts working with somebody, he has to, in the first session, get his head into a place where he is genuinely saying to that person, without saying it in words, but genuinely feeling it, that you are perfect just the way you are. Now, let's do what we can to make your life better, but you're perfect just the way you are. In other words, see the essential humanity in other people. And I think that, you know, maybe I can do this because my father was a Republican and a conservative, and we used to debate politics, you know, literally through his entire life, or, you know, the last 40 years of his entire life, and or 50 years thereabouts. And I mean, I didn't know him before I was born, when he was 22, but and I didn't debate politics in the first few years of my life, the first decade of my life. But I loved my dad. I love my dad. I mean, he's gone now, but I loved my dad. And we used to get into knockdown, drag-out arguments. But I never lost sight of the fact that he was a human being. He was somebody that I loved and cared about. And I think that it taught me that there's a human on the other side of that argument, no matter who you're arguing with and no matter what the topic is. And I think it's something that we all need to be carrying into our lives. So that's my story. And feel free to share yours. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How do we teach our colleagues to be politically active and be not their politics? Because I think it makes you more effective as a political actor. Okay, so speaking of the brain, you know, it seems like a reasonable tangent. This is interesting. Shannon pointed this out to me. Somehow I missed this story in this morning's Washington Post. President Obama has proposed today mapping the human brain. He wants to spend $100 million to map the human brain. He says we might discover new cures for neurological disease. We might strengthen our economy. Ideas are what power our economy. Let's get the best ideas. $100 million to map the human brain. Conservatives. Well, actually, this Jeff 9K posting over at Democratic Underground says Republicans balked at the price tag, saying that a conservative brain could be mapped for half that price. Bum-bum. Okay. Johnny in Lamarck. Is it Lamarck, Texas, or Lamarck?
Lamarck.
Lamarck, Texas.
You'll get it right sometime.
One of these days I will, Johnny. You just never know when towns have been anglicized. I used to live in Montpelier, Vermont, and people would come to town and they'd go, oh, Montpelier, and we'd go, no, it's Montpelier.
Yeah, I know. So, America is funny that way.
Yeah. So what's up?
Anyway, the thought train, I love the idea of the thought train, and lots of us humans do that a lot, but we don't realize that we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the idea of your father, and I don't know him, I'm sure he's a swell guy because he brought you into the world. Did he ever in his life, would he have ever incited constituents in his party, if he was a politician, to resort to bullets if the ballot didn't go the way of his party? Would he be like a Michelle Bachmann or Sharon Angle or Alan West or
no.
John Boehner
no.
or that disabled old white guy in that wheelchair who on his website urged people to break glass storefronts of local Democratic campaign offices?
No. No, no, my father was not a fan of violence. You know, he was in Japan after World War II. He saw violence.
Put that aside for a moment. And now think about all the liberals, with some moderates and some conservatives, out in the Occupy protest movements back in 2011. Back, as if that's ancient history. It's still going on, though. But think about all those people who exhibited as much peace and love and sharing as humanly possible, in spite of all the kind of physical violence put upon them by the people who are supposed to be protecting and serving, who get paid by their dime.
Sure. The iconic moment was those that group of young college students who were sitting at, what was it, the University of California, Davis, as I recall, and the police just walked down the row, pepper spraying them in the face, and they just sat there. I mean, it was just that. That's the power of nonviolence. I thought that was extraordinary.
Well, and I respect that if you're ready, willing, and able to endure that.
Right.
And I respect Representative John Lewis.
Yes.
I don't think I could have done that, especially if I was. I had my skull crashed within an inch of my life.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking about all these people who you referenced in your news before, about all these soon-to-be retirees, like in Stockton, California. What do you think they're going to do? They're not all liberals. You get enough people in this country who are now approaching retirement age who are going to get screwed over by this runaway capitalist system that has no compunction
at all. No, a lot of them already have been. I mean, when they were in their 30s and 40s, they had pensions which have now been converted into 401ks, and then they lost half of them in the stock market crash, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. Johnny, is that your point?
Well, my point is I think there's plenty of room for way more liberals to take the contrary view, not just the way of Martin Luther King, but a little bit of Malcolm, because all right. If we always turn the other cheek, there's always going to be enough of people on the other side who are prone to violence who will take that route in order to get their way. I just don't want to see our people wind up like those people I saw
in the end,
black
though,
and whites from the 1930s Germany being dragged off and never to be seen again.
Yeah.
That's where I'm afraid we're headed, Tom. And
Johnny, respectfully, thank you for the call. But, you know, respectfully, we're not headed there. The United States is not Germany. We do not have a cult leader. We do not have a cult that is running this country. Although if things get bad enough, I mean, I just saw this ad for the Golden Dawn in Greece, which is the new kind of Nazi party in Greece, and they're now reaching out to the world, and it's pretty scary. Greg in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Greg Ospensky.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you again. Sometimes I'm amazed how similar our paths through life have been. I was a student in an Ospensky school for a couple of years back in my 20s.
They have schools?
And learned there was a school in California that I was a part of for 2 years.
Wow.
And you did hit upon certain things that are the essence of Ospensky, and I'd like to expand on that briefly if I could.
Please.
One of the things that he talked about was what he called an observing eye, where you feel a sense of detachment from what it is you're observing.
Yep.
And and the other point that I'd like to make is that he clearly brought up the distinction between what he called false personality in a person and their real personality.
Mm-hmm.
And false personality is something that functions with negative emotions and is a vehicle for expressing them.
Mm-hmm.
And his philosophy was to be able to separate yourself in two so you have a very clear picture of yourself in the grip of false personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of touches upon what you're saying in relationship to somebody not being their politics.
Yeah.
It's like not being their opinions.
Yeah.
And it's quite a deep study. I wish you were still in Portland. I met you in Portland years ago.
Yeah.
And I'd love to have dinner and talk about this for about 2 hours.
Yeah, I could talk about it for weeks.
Time will not allow.
Yeah.
But his approach to things. He was also quite a famous mathematician in Russia before he met Gurdjieff.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and he went off in search of an enlightenment or a person who he thought was enlightened. And
he was looking for an esoteric school because he figured that he had found traces of esoteric schools.
Right.
And that they move around and have to be somewhat behind a facade so that the powers that be will not come.
Right, and then he found Gurdjieff. And then as the Russian Revolution was happening in the background, these guys were, you know, kind of, well, he was, it seemed like, you know, all the stuff Gurdjieff was talking about, of, you know, people going crazy because they had become.
I agree with the difficulty about Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. I couldn't finish it either.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was actually quite a large schism and a split between Gurdjieff and Ospensky in the 30s, I believe.
Oh, was there?
And quite an interesting story about that. But,
okay.
Greg,
I got to move along. But thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that. And like I said, my study of this has been limited to having read three of Ospensky's books and trying to read one of Gurdjieff's. I briefly showed up four or five times for an Ospensky study group in one of the cities that we lived in like 20 years ago, and I don't even remember where it was, but it was an interesting group, and then Louise and I moved on. So, but Greg, thank you for the call, and much appreciated. Dorothy in Redding, California, you have a technique for talking to conservatives to discuss
sure
politics?
I sure do. First of all, I want to tell you I've had Charter for years, and I just switched to Dish Network. I am so glad. I had no idea you existed.
Oh, great.
Well, thank you. I live in Shasta County. It's the gun capital, Tea Party capital of California. It's known all over. And in fact, it was where they showed on Keith Olbermann's show when he was still on TV, and they showed the man that stood up to the representative and said, "I am proud to be a right-wing terrorist." Mm-hmm. They showed it all over. So anyway, I live here.
Yeah.
I'm probably not as nice as you are in trying to imagine other people as human beings, too. I tried that. I went through years of metaphysical study. It's the thing that works for me is akin to if you're speaking before a group and you're very nervous, you picture them all naked.
Right.
So that's what has worked for me. It's the only way I've survived here, because everywhere you go, you hear derogatory remarks about liberals or this or that. It's just there. It's all over the town.
Right.
I couldn't put an Obama sticker on my car because I had friends that did and had their cars scratched up. It's that bad.
Yeah.
And our Democratic headquarters had the glass smashed in. So when I'm talking to someone and they start in like that, you know, bashing liberals and this and that, my technique is to just picture them with a huge wart on the end of their nose.
Uh-huh.
Or I'll put a Mickey Mouse hat on them.
Yep.
Or I'll picture them with bunny slippers on their feet. Something that totally takes away the power they have over me. And this, I find, is what works for me. I have to do this if I'm talking to someone, and it totally detaches me and takes away the power that I have given them, because we give them the power.
Yeah, I don't disagree. In neurolinguistic programming, that's called a submodality shift. And you can do this if you have a memory that irritates you or annoys you or some experience. You can just bring that up as a movie, run it backwards, put rainbows across it, have people talk like Donald Duck, put bunny ears on them, give them big noses or buck teeth or something, so very, very exaggerated, very funny, and it will dissipate the emotion attached to that recollection. I've never known anybody who did it in real time. I actually have used it as a therapeutic technique with people to deal with past memories that bother them, and I've done it myself. But in real time, that's fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah.
It really works. Let me tell you, if there's anyone out there that's listening that's going through what I am or living in a place where I am,
start putting bunny slippers on people. That is great. You know,
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Dorothy. By the way, the imagining people naked in the audience strategy to not have stage fright, I tried that once and it didn't work. It didn't seem to make any difference. And then Louise booked me to give a speech once, and I showed up, and it was a nudist colony. So I actually was speaking to a group of people. Well, about half of them had nothing on. And it didn't seem to make much difference. I still get nervous when I speak in front of people. But, you still do it, right? You still do it. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So as Obama wants to map the human mind, how do our minds work? And how do we disconnect ourselves from believing that we are our politics? Welcome back to Viagra for Your Brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. Robert in Columbia, Maryland. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom. It's good to speak with you again. And I work with Peter from We Act Radio.
Oh, cool.
We met a few times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are we our politics? I don't know. This is a difficult one, because I think America, people are more their propaganda than the politics. I mean, how many conservatives do we know? No, our politics are really twisted, and I think that my opinion on this is people should be their politics more. Should look internally.
I think we need to be more politically active. I think that, I end the show every day. Democracy begins with you. Go out there, get active, tag, you're it. We all need to be more politically active, but if we do it out of a place of being out of control, if we do it out of a place of reaction, if we do it out of a place of anger and reactivity, we are less potent, we are less powerful, we are less competent than if we do it out of a place of thoughtfulness, of self-awareness. That's my point. Does that make sense?
Good. Okay. Yes, that makes sense.
That's what I mean when I say I am not my politics. Is, you know, I'm me. I'm Tom, and you know, I'm the husband to my wife. I'm the father to my kids. I'm the friend to my friends. I'm the, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, there's a lot of different roles that I have in life that we all have, and occasionally I run across people. In fact, more and more frequently it seems. Who would say that the number one, the top thing that they are is that they are conservative or they are liberal or they are a communist or a Republican or, fill in the blank, some kind of political label. And, you know, that's all well and good unless, except it starts where it starts being corrosive is when it subsumes everything else. And I live in a, you know, I eat, drink, sleep, talk politics constantly. And yet I know that I am also something other than just politics, that there's also other things going on there. So anyway, Robert, thank you for the thoughtful comment. Appreciate the call. Ted in Palace Hills, Illinois, and listening to WCPT. Hey, Ted.
Hi, Tom. How are you? About being your politics, you know, I was just thinking, I've heard you say this before. You know, in Europe, other countries, the Netherlands, et cetera, you know, you have more than one rational party, okay, that to choose from, to explore. You may have one or two offshoots that are completely, non-considerable, like the Nazi Party in Greece, et cetera, you know, just way out in the fringe, but you have one or two rational options. Right. You know, in the U.S., you know, there's really only these two options, and the people that I know that are conservative, okay, don't see who's behind the curtain, okay? So while they are trying to be their politics, it's kind of like they are being something that doesn't really exist because they don't know that the drive behind their politics is something other than what they believe. It's, they're being, you know, kind of duped in a sense, you know, to believe that, you know, that these people are representative of them when it's really, you know, about the people that pay them, the corporations, you know, the multimillionaires, the billionaires, et cetera, you know, so they don't really, they're not really, they can't really be their politics. Whereas on the other side, you know, I can kind of understand standing up and for what you believe in, as far as, you know, helping the sick and as far as helping the poor and about everybody having a shot.
Okay. Well, I think even you know, being Nelson Mandela and going to prison for your politics is, I'm all in favor of people being assertive and participate. I'm not saying, you know, sit and gaze at your navel all day. I'm just saying, don't make the mistake of thinking that that you're not greater than your politics. Am I making sense? Maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm not communicating. I think that we live in a time where we cannot afford not to have political opinions and not to act on them. So then the question becomes, how are we most effective at acting on our political opinions? And I believe that when we are acting in a way that is purely reactive, when we are reflexive, when we're responsive, rather than being active, proactive, that we are weaker, frankly. And that if we're active rather than, and proactive rather than reactive, we're stronger. And our voice is clearer and our understanding is deeper and, you know, the place that we're grounded in, that our politics are grounded in. I understand my political opinions. I understand the worldview that I'm talking about. I've seen it work in other countries. I've seen it work here in the United States. I've seen the conservative vision not work. I've seen it fail. And I've seen, you know, there's some small good pieces to it and I've seen some of them work. But by and large, you know, particularly the idea of the traditional conservative idea of taking things cautious, being cautious, thinking things through, which is not what today's people who call themselves conservatives do. These guys are reactionaries. But I think that there's an element of consciousness to this. Ted, I got to want to get a couple more calls here, and I just have a minute left. Thank you for the call. Betty in Arroyo Grande, California. Hey, Betty.
Hi. I really enjoy your program, and I enjoy all the information that you give to us and the truth of knowing what's going on in the world. And
thank you, Betty. Your point, we're very short on time.
Okay. What I do after watching your program, which sometimes gets me stirred up inside because of the news,
yeah.
I put on a tape that chants Om Hari Om, and I play that for about an hour, and I get settled down again, and I can go on and not feel the anxiety that the world presents to us today.
So you meditate, basically.
Yeah, sort of. I go about my business, but I listen to the tape in the background.
Yeah, that's great. I sit and meditate every morning, just for a few minutes. I just think this is like healthy stuff. Betty, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back. We're going to have a contest. Is Scotty Nell Hughes going to show up? Oh, this should be interesting. The chief journalist for the Tea Party News Network will be with us next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Second hour of our program. Scotty Nell Hughes is on the line with us, news director and chief journalist at the Tea Party News Network, contributor to Patriot.tv and PatriotUpdate.com, website TPNN, as in Tea Party News Network.com. Scotty, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me back on, Tom. Always a joy to be with you.
Thank you. You wrote an article called One Nation Above God, in which you point out that the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte this past September voted not once, you say, but three times to deny the reinstatement of God into their platform. And you wrap this up. Your last paragraph says, Matthew 27:46, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, cried Jesus in his last few moments before he died on the cross at Calvary. Today, almost 2,000 years later, considering the pattern of anti-Christian actions, unfortunately not isolated to those Democrat residents, I'm assuming you mean Democratic Party, the Democrat residents of Palm Beach County and the Democratic voters of the DNC, many Christians wonder if there is a line where God will ever forsake us. Are you suggesting that our political parties should be embracing any particular religion, in this case Christianity, that, you know, for the purposes of politics? Really?
Well, obviously one of the big arguments is the separation of church and state, and many times that has been given over and over.
It's not just a big argument. It was part of the basis of the American Revolution.
Well, but it's also, you got to look and realize what the separation of church and state is, how it's been twisted and formed. It's not like our founding fathers said that they did not want to be God in the country. Obviously, in God we trust. We look at different things.
That was in 1954. That was not the founding generation, Scotty. In God we trust was put on our coins in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration in response to Joe McCarthy's fear-mongering. But back to you. You will not find it in any of our founding documents.
Well, but you also have to realize what they didn't want was God in our government. They didn't want the government telling us what exactly we should or should not be doing in regards to our religion. More importantly, forcing us to do the same type of life that they had over in England. So fast forward to today, where we have been sitting here, and traditionally Christians have been told to turn the other cheek when it comes to issues like this, which the story was, like you said, down in Palm Beach, the professor, Dr. Good, literally had them write Jesus on a piece of paper, meditate on it, and then stomp on the paper and destroy the paper. And the one student who did it, the Mormon, who said, no, I cannot do this, was kicked out of class.
Well, that sounds crazy to me.
The professor.
But that's not the Democratic Party, Scotty. I mean, we can both find examples of people behaving crazily around religion. But your argument here is that over and over again, you say more and more people are trying to be more bold in desecrating our faith. I'm very concerned. I mean, James, the James Madison and Thomas Jefferson had this big debate about the Establishment Clause. You know, there shall be no establishment of religion in the United States, no official religion. That there shall be no religious test for any person to work for the government of the United States. Jefferson was concerned that if religious people ever took political office, that they might corrupt the government with their religion. Madison thought that was crazy, but he was worried that if the government ever started giving money to the churches, that would corrupt the churches. Madison was a Christian. Jefferson was not. He was a deist. But I think they ended up both being right. Madison's first veto as president of the United States, as fourth president of the United States, was to veto a bill that, you know, starting in the George Washington administration, Congress had been directly giving money to a home for homeless people and poor people here in Washington, D.C., providing them with food, housing, and medical care. And during the Madison administration, Congress said, hey, let's run this through the church. And so they started, so they passed a bill saying, we're going to give this money to the Presbyterian Church here in Washington, D.C. to take care for the poor. Madison, that was his first veto. And he said, because giving money to a church begins the corruption of the churches. The government should not be in religion, and religion should not be in government.
But that's where you and I are different. That's where it kind of continues.
Well, apparently that's where you and James Madison are
ideology.
Different.
And you can say that's those are the facts as you want to look at them. I want to look at it as the fact that they did not want to see what happened in England, which originally drove them out of England, happen here to where the
Wait a minute. Do you know the story of Cromwell?
In every part of life, it was the church which was really the king, the governor, or the government working through it.
Scotty, do you know the story of Cromwell?
They didn't want a country founded on God.
Do you know the story of Cromwell? What happened in England was that a fundamentalist Christian zealot overthrew the king, and for 7 years, as I recall, ruled England and declared that dancing was illegal, singing was illegal. They started a really aggressive persecution of women, and finally, after 7 years, this was the Puritans. Finally, after 7 years, the British people said, you know, get rid of this. We want the damn king back. It was better with a king. And they threw Cromwell out. He got killed, as I recall. I mean, it's been a long time since I've studied this part of British history. And those followers of Cromwell who still wanted to have, you know, a ban on dancing and things like that, they got on a boat and came over to Massachusetts to Plymouth Rock, and they set up, you know, their little theocracy here. And that group of Puritans in Massachusetts was the bane of the founding fathers. I mean, Ben Franklin used to go off on long. He fled Massachusetts when he was 17 years old because of the Puritans. Moved to Philadelphia. Philadelphia was like the anti-Puritan bastion.
Well, and for a while there, I was thinking you were describing Footloose. I was thinking maybe you had backtracked when you had watched, you know, the 1980s thriller Footloose. But,
no.
You know, there are certain points, and this is where obviously we can talk about religious philosophies and what actually defined a true Christian and what did it and what was actually the actions of the church and what was the government using the church. We can look at it.
Well, what did Jesus say when the centurion came to him?
And the fact that Christianity is under attack. We have seen prayer taken out of school, Christian prayer taken out of school. They can still have Muslim prayer. They can still have Buddhist prayer.
No,
they cannot have Christian prayer in school led by a teacher. We've seen Ten Commandments taken out of our
Judaism. Scotty, you're not representing the truth.
That's the problem. That's the issue.
It's no, wait a minute.
Religions allowed
to
act except for Christians.
Maybe I'm wrong. But my understanding is that no teacher can lead any prayer of any religion. And that, on the other hand, if a kid wants to pray in school, whether it's praying to Allah or praying to Jesus, they are welcome to do that. There is no prohibition on prayer in school. There is a prohibition on somebody who takes a paycheck from the government deciding, dictating, and leading the prayer in school. And I want it that way, frankly, because the day, you know, I even as a religious person, I guess I would say, the day may come when somebody decides that the religion that, you know, I don't want, you know, it to be Scientology or Mormonism or you know, fill in the blank, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I've probably just, you know, angered, you know, three different groups of my viewers and listeners. But, you know, or fundamentalist Christian, anybody. I just don't think that we should be paying our tax dollars to have somebody indoctrinate our children in religion, even a religion we agree with.
What we did is, with this example, let me take what you just said. our tax dollars went to buy the textbooks that had this exercise in it that specifically mentioned to stomp on the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
So you just proved my point, the fact that there is.
That shouldn't be, Scotty. You and I agree on that.
It didn't say any.
That shouldn't be.
Symbol. It said Jesus specifically.
No, well, that shouldn't be. I mean, if what you're saying is true, and I'm guessing that that's no longer the case, that the first time somebody pointed that out, that book was history. But if that's true,
it's still there.
Then,
the university is still using it.
Well, then I join with you in condemning that.
And this textbook is in universities across the United States, paid for by taxpayer dollars. That right there proves my point that there is an assault. Didn't mention Muhammad, didn't mention Buddha, didn't mention anything else. It mentioned Jesus specifically. And that's where we have an issue right now.
Okay, well, let's get rid of that book from any school.
But it's not just one book. There's a publisher that published that book. There's somebody else that published a book that goes along with it. There's a whole.
But what you want to do is you want to put a different book into the school that says promote religion. And that worries.
Well, I agree in an equal tolerance across the board, but this one was an outright attack on Jesus and those that pertain to his faith.
Okay.
And it was approved by the
Scotty Nell Hughes, news director, chief journalist, the Tea Party Newsletter, TPNN.com. Thank you, Scotty.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, should religion be in our schools? No, I just don't think so. I really don't think so. I think it's bad for religion. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Andrew calling from San Jose, California, listening on Progressive Voices. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hello again, Tom. I wanted to comment about the guest you had at the top of the hour who was talking about the stomping on Jesus incident.
Scotty, yeah.
And I'd just like to correct something and to clarify what really happened as an atheist who regularly reads such blogs. Basically, this Mormon student at Florida Atlantic University objected to an exercise that the professor DeAndre Poole was giving him in a class called Intercultural Communication.
Right.
Where they were being trained in symbolism, I think it is. And then he raised a big fuss about it on the right-wing blogs, and then they, even Governor Rick Scott apologized to the student. So,
right. This was not in a book. This was something that a professor decided to do, and the goal of it apparently, Danielle just handed me a story about it. The goal of it apparently was to give these Christians some sense of how Muslims must feel if the Quran is desecrated. Do I have that right?
I think that the professor saw it in a textbook and assigned it as some kind of critical thinking thing. But in that case, it was one of those right-wing outrage of the day stories. And in that case, do you think that it's worth it?
If it was in a book, I mean, I've got this story here, and you would think that the book itself would be named somewhere in the story. I don't see it anywhere. It is a textbook. Okay. Very interesting.
People can look it up on Friendly Atheist or whatever blogs.
Yeah.
I think they'll see the book.
Yeah.
But just to clarify.
Andrew, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's, you know, but again, it's, I disagree. I would personally say, you know, okay, we could talk about how would a Muslim feel about the Quran being, well, the American soldiers, I think the most famous case was they urinated on it. How would you feel as a Christian if somebody did that to a Bible or something like that? You know, but I think that this is being blown all out of proportion, frankly. Randy in Marshall, Arkansas, you are a high school teacher and a preacher?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What are your thoughts?
A couple of comments about the Tea Party lady. Number one, I mean, it really kind of struck me. She's talking about something that went on at a public university, but, you know, I went to public university and private school, college, and I always had to pay for my own books. So, I mean, she's railing about, you know, textbooks paid for by taxpayer money. Number one, have you ever gone to a college where taxpayer money paid for your textbooks?
Not since the 60s, yeah.
The other issue I would take is what the last gentleman said, which is, I kind of, as an English teacher, assumed that this was something to do with symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I had that pegged, which is kind of a neat thing. But, you know, look, I'm a Christian and I'm a preacher. And, I'm not going to be excited about stomping on the name of Jesus on a piece of paper. On the other hand, in an exercise talking about symbolism and the fact that the letters on the page are nothing more than letters on the page, they are a symbol of something else, I can kind of understand where that might be coming from.
Yeah.
And so, like you say, I think what we're talking about is something that's been really blown up, you know, out of proportion. One final thought. You're familiar with Fahrenheit 451, right?
Ray
Bradbury?
Yeah. I mean, I read the book when I was like 17 or something. It's been a long time. That's the temperature at which paper burns, and it had to do with censorship. That's my recollection of it. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, one of the things in that particular short story, or actually that novel, is that, you know, they have Jesus selling toothpaste in the subway. I mean, you know, and that's really what we're kind of heading for, I think, if we say, you know, Jesus needs to be in this and he needs to be in that. And if she's offended by, I don't know, you know, what went on at this university, it just strikes me that we're you know, we're going to come to a point where we're so desensitized to it that he will be selling things. Of course, he probably already does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there some kind of advertising out there that uses Jesus around Christmas time to get somebody to buy something?
Oh, there's great piles of it. And what I find so amazing is that Bill O'Reilly every year at Christmas time goes on this tirade about how retailers are not using Jesus to sell things. Instead, they're saying happy holidays instead of saying it's Jesus' birthday, buy something.
And I just, you know, I think that diminishes him, don't you? I mean, it just seems to me to be the opposite of what we ought to be interested in.
I agree.
And especially as a free people, you know, as a free people where, like I say, as a preacher who teaches, I don't preach to my kids except through my life. You know, I mean, my lifestyle is what it is, but I don't stand before them and preach. If they ask me questions, we can discuss and we talk about things. I'm dealing with older, you know, high school kids, but I think that's the way it ought to be. I mean, I have the freedom to discuss what they asked me.
Yeah. Well, you're
a point to proselytize. You know?
Yeah. Excellent point, Randy. And your life is always going to be your greatest example. Randy, thank you. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your experience with us. Jess in Oracle, Arizona. Hey, Jess, what's up?
Yeah, I just heard you talking to that lady about paying people to not teach, you know, not paying people to teach religion.
Right.
But in essence, we're doing that through subsidizing our churches by allowing them not to pay taxes.
Agreed. Right. And we're also doing that through voucher systems that I think 17 states now have voucher systems where public money is used, can be used to send your kids to a private religious school. And I completely disagree with that. I think that you know, if you want to send your kids to a religious school, you should do it with your own money, not with my money.
Yeah, I think we should. Any churches that have over a certain amount of people, they ought to pay taxes anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, eventually we're going to end up if the way that we're subsidizing religious schools increasingly with tax dollars is it's going to be like in some of these Muslim countries where the kids have to, the only education that's available is through the madrasa, is through the religious school. And, you know, arguably back in the Middle Ages in Europe, that was the same thing. The only education that was available was through church schools. And I don't think it worked out so well for society. I think that the American experiment of having a secular nation and having you know, independent schools is a good thing. I agree with James Madison. Jess, thanks for the call. And Thomas Jones. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, courtesy of Stamps.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, boy, we've got a lot of... How do you debate politics without getting stuck to it? Or is that even a good thing? I mean, maybe we should just all segregate ourselves by our politics and say, you know, I don't want any conservatives in my life, period. Or I don't want any liberals in my life, you know, depending on. I don't think so. Peter in Roselle, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I was going to talk to you about politics, but in light of your last guest, I'm hoping you're going to give me a little bit of latitude. I'd like to give you a little quiz.
Okay.
It's just a quick quiz. Name three things that you're not supposed to talk about in company.
Well, I mean, classically, what is it? Religion, politics, and I don't know.
Finance, money.
And money, okay.
All right. Name three things that are the most contentious things that an adult will have to deal with in their life. religious, politics, and finance.
Okay.
Name three things that are woefully untaught in public school K through 12.
Yeah, well, I think comparative religion would be a good thing to teach. And what boggles my mind is that kids graduate from high school not knowing how to change a baby's diaper or balance a checkbook.
Exactly. But religion is important in people's lives, whether they believe in anything or they don't. They're going to have to deal with it in their lives. And if they're not taught theology K through 12, how are they going to discuss it?
Well, that's where I said, I am all in favor of teaching comparative religion, teaching it from a sociological, anthropological, psychological perspective, however you want. You know, here's the difference so that somebody, when they grow up, they understand the difference in worldviews and religious principles between Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and Christians and within the Christian church, since it's so predominant here in the United States, the difference between Catholics and Protestants and the two types of Protestantism, those that came from Martin Luther and those that came from Henry VIII. And just that basic stuff, which I think could probably be covered in a week or two. But people should have that basic understanding. But that's a different thing than teaching people that they should follow a particular religion, or that a particular religion is right and other religions are wrong.
Correct. Correct. That's exactly right. They should be introduced to all religions and all viewpoints so that they can communicate and get along with their fellow citizens. Same thing with politics. I think politics is really contentious now because it's not taught. People don't know how to speak about it. They don't know how to separate themselves from the politics. They've never had the experience because you don't talk about it at home. You don't talk about it when you're out with people. You're told not to talk about it.
And God forbid you talk about it in school because however you talk about it, the other party's going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Interesting point, Peter. So we need to have comparative politics classes, comparative religion classes, and how to balance your checkbook classes. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, look at the whole Enron debacle. And, you know, people had 80% of their retirement money in company stock.
Yeah, they should have known better, but they didn't. Well, they all thought it was going to go up forever. But they had a con man who was running their company, Ken Lay, and he had surrounded himself with a bunch of con men. And he had people like Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, who was, on his board, who was helping actually convert this stuff into legislation, or Phil was anyway. But Peter, good point. Thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Nancy in Kunkeltown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I told your young lady that I listen to you nearly every day, and very frequently when I'm listening to you speak with the assortment of people that you speak with, I think of a old saying that I ran across, and I don't remember where I found it, but I'm a retired teacher, so I'm into words and phrases and whatever. And the one that immediately pops to my mind every time I listen to you taking on these people, I think of this one, which is entrenched belief is never altered by the facts.
Yeah, although I think that it can be. I'm just speaking for myself, but there have been many times in my life when I thought I knew what was, when I believed something very intensely, and something came along that caused me to go, maybe I was wrong. And
well, I think that's relative to you being open-minded.
And you think that's relatively rare?
After 35 years in the classroom and all the people I've run across, I think you're lucky if you can open people's minds.
Yeah. Well, I suspect you're right.
It's not to say one should stop trying.
Yeah.
However, it's a very difficult task to take on.
Yeah.
And I have the utmost admiration for you for doing it.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I just, I look at the history of America. You look at America, there was a time, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, I mean, even during the Republican Eisenhower administration, where everybody, not everybody, but the vast majority of Americans said, Social Security, it's a good thing. I mean, Eisenhower ran for re-election in 1956, bragging about the fact that he had expanded the Social Security rolls and that 2 million more people had joined unions during his first 4 years of his presidency. So there was a time when there was a consensus in America that, that the New Deal was a good thing. And then Reagan came along and changed that. Now we're at a time where there's, you know, I think probably a, I think it's going away, but I'd say, you know, 10 years ago, there was probably a consensus in America that maybe we should be pulling back from some of those things. Now we've had the experiment with that and it crashed the economy, but, I have to think that Americans are capable of changing their thinking. It might just be a generational thing. I don't know, but I have to believe that Americans are capable of changing their thinking because we have. You know, we've done that numerous times through our history. But, Nancy, good point. Thank you so much for your kind words. Bruce in Buffalo, New York, you wanted to expand on Ouspensky?
Hey, yes. Rudolf Steiner wrote something about characterological predisposition. And we have to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
You did it. You were raised, as I was, a right-wing Republican, and yet you overcame it. You overcame this predisposition. But I think this is why many people argue, and they're arguing more or less on the surface, and they don't realize that the basic character of the individual, the predisposition, if I may, mm-hmm. It's coming from a different corner of the universe, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about objective thinking, objectifying our thinking.
Right.
And I think the answer to this is in learning how to think more clearly, more honestly.
Yeah. And also learning to question our own thinking and question our own thinking processes. Critical thinking, basically. We used to actually teach critical thinking in schools, and we not only do we not anymore, but now we teach memorization, you know, which is not even thinking, and is more of the problem. I'm with you, Bruce. Thank you. Very, very, very well said. George in Miami, Florida. Hey, George, what's up?
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good.
I was listening, and I thought I heard a topic about whether or not religion should be in schools.
Right.
And I was perplexed by that because it seems to me that religion is in schools. And I don't know if I had misunderstood the topic, but it just seems like to me that if you have a Christmas break, if you have an Easter break, it kind of suggests that you're in observance of the fact that perhaps you need a Christmas break or a quote-unquote Easter break.
Right, and we don't have Ramadan breaks. We don't have Passover breaks.
Well, it's debatable whether or not we have a Passover break because they kind of time it in the jurisdiction where I live, and it's in Miami, Florida. They just call it a Jewish holiday. They don't specify which holiday it is.
Right.
But it opens the door for discussions on it. I don't think elementary school students or even high school students, if you come under the banner of separation of church and state and you are taught that principle, should be subjected to those types of holidays, because if one of the students asks the question, well, why is it that we have a Christmas break? And, you know, then what is Christmas? And it opens the door for a discussion,
right,
which would have the effect of educating along those religious lines.
Well, increasingly, the Easter break is now the spring break. The Christmas break is now the holiday New Year break.
Winter break. Yeah, right. But see, that's how that basic compromise is how religion, as it stands today, evolved, because there were some quote unquote Christian principles that were in conflict with the pagan rituals. And so, of course, there was a basic marriage of the thing so that it was allowed under political niceties, if you will, to exist. Yeah. For example, when we say the Easter holiday, well, what does a bunny rabbit have to do with the principles of Easter as it relates to the ascension of what is represented to be the Christ?
Well,
so, you know,
nothing. But there was a time when in the spring people wanted to make sure that their crops grew, and so they had fertility rituals where they put blood on the ground to make sure that. And it might have actually even increased crop yields because it's a good fertilizer. I get your point, George. These things have been co-opted by religion. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And President Obama today saying $100 million to map the human brain. Interesting. Republicans are pushing back, except for Newt. He likes it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Ellen, what's going on?
Well, you know, the president came out today with this $100 million for brain research, and I think that's wonderful, except when you look at the $100 million, it's nothing compared to what they think is going to happen with Alzheimer's disease, which is to cost us as much as $20 trillion over the next 40 years.
Trillion with a T.
Trillion with a T.
Wow.
So $100 million, I mean, they're going to have trouble getting that through Congress because Congress is sort of short-sighted, particularly the Republicans. But the fact is we need all hands on deck if we're going to fight this disease.
Yeah. I'm also still a little concerned about how much of what is being diagnosed as Alzheimer's might actually be mad cow disease or some sort of prion disease.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. But how are we ever going to find that out if you don't put the research into it?
Yeah, yeah. So $100 million is a drop in the bucket. But
that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yep. Okay, I'm with you.
Okay, some other things. The NRA today came out with their grand plan. They put former Congressman Asa Hutchinson in. Now, he was only a two-term congressman from Arizona, so we're wondering, why him? Well, we did a little research down in the White House basement, all of us, together when we were wondering about this, and lo and behold, it looks like he's going to try and probably run for governor. So he's putting himself out there in a big way, governor probably
Kansas?
Of his state, and I'm having a senior moment on the state right now.
Asa Hutchinson, is that Arizona, or is it Missouri, or Kansas?
It's the same state Clinton is from.
Yeah.
Begins with an A.
Oh, Arkansas.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, the United Nations passed the agreement on weapons. The gun folks are completely freaking out about the Second Amendment. They say the treaty absolutely has no reach inside the United States, only cross borders. They need two-thirds are needed for advice and consent, but you know the Constitution does provide that the president makes and signs treaties. They just need the advice and consent.
So are you saying that a treaty can be signed by the president that has not been
passed
through the
Senate? No, well, it can be, but it's
not going to be ratified. Yeah, okay. So, and this is bizarre because the Republican argument against this UN treaty is that it has something to do with the Second Amendment, but what the treaty says is if you're a gun dealer in the United States and you want to start shipping weapons to Somalia, there's a process for regulating that.
That's exactly right. But
it says nothing about if you're a gun dealer in Virginia and you want to ship guns to West Virginia. The UN's got nothing to do with that.
That's right.
Incredible.
But the NRA is, of course, freaking out because anytime you mention a gun, they freak out.
Well, and the gun manufacturers who fund the NRA make weapons that are sold all over the world.
We are the biggest exporter of arms of any country in the world.
That's incredible.
That's just crazy. Okay. Senator Mark Kirk, as you know, he had a severe stroke, was out for several months. He said when he walked up those steps in January to take his seat again in the Senate, he said, life is too short, people deserve to be happy, and he has now come out supporting gay marriage.
Good on him.
I mean, pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's almost happening like one a day, you know.
It is happening one a day, but you know, Huffington Post every day posts the senators, the Democratic senators who don't support gay marriage. Yeah. You now have 50 senators, including the two Republicans, supporting it. You really only need one more for a simple majority, and you need the other nine who don't to say that they're going to let the bill go through.
Right, they're going to abstain from filibustering.
That's right.
Interesting.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, it would. The problem is getting it through the House.
Right, which is not going to happen.
Not maybe until 2014, January 2015.
Hopefully.
Yes.
Senator Leahy sent today a letter to Senator Rubio on immigration.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the work of this committee, particularly the Gang of Eight, as it's called, should not be behind closed doors. He urged them to act quickly, but he sent it pointedly to Rubio, who's, of course, saying, oh, well, we don't have any agreement, and he wants to see the language, and, of course, trying to slow-mo it, even though since he is running for president, I happen to know he's already trying to put his team together.
Very interesting. Not surprising, but very interesting.
Not surprising at all. The president met with the prime minister of Singapore at the White House. They said they affirmed their strong economic relationship. Of course, human rights, well, they didn't exactly go there.
Yeah, well, not increasingly. I mean, historically around the world, we've looked out for our economic interests first.
For sure. And obviously, that's an important part of the world because of China.
Yep.
And by the way, with North Korea, you know, trying to put out all their trial balloons, whether it's the reactor or whatever, I mean, China is really the only country that can get them to stop doing their craziness.
Do you think that they're doing their craziness because, I mean, this is what the North always does when there's a new president in the South, and there's a new president in the South. But in addition to that, very often when they do this kind of craziness, they get rewarded.
They get rewarded, yes. I always call it their funding trips across the world.
Right.
Because then they get, well, okay, stop doing your nuclear reactor like they did in 2007, and we'll send you food aid.
Right.
Now, it is interesting, and this was a unanimous pass, as I recall, just a few weeks ago at the Security Council, that you cannot send to North Korea any luxury items.
Right.
Because what was happening, of course, is the leadership was getting all these fancy luxury items, and they didn't care.
So they could party down with Dennis Rodman.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now,
exactly.
Going to put a stop to that. That's going to be interesting.
Well, and I actually think China will put a stop to that. I think China does not have an interest in supporting.
There are some very serious people, capital S, capital P, some very serious people in this city who are concerned that with new leadership in the South, and particularly a woman who has to deal with, you know, sexism and the suggestions that she may not be strong enough because she is a woman as the president of South Korea, and a new leader in the North who is a young guy who seems to be a little delusional.
Who also has his internal problems with the military.
Yeah, that this may be actually a tinderbox. That, you know, these... Are you concerned?
I'm concerned it could get out of control, and nobody intends it to, exactly.
Yeah, okay. I am too. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen, thank you for being
thank
with
you.
Us. Thank you. For talking. We'll be back. Neil McCabe is going to be with us. It's going to be fun. Stick with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me Neil McCabe, a conservative commentator and editor at the Guns and Patriot newsletter. Neil, welcome to the program.
Happy Easter, Tom, to you and your listeners.
Thank you, and happy
and
Easter
viewers.
To you, too, although it's past, is it not?
Well, this is Easter Tuesday, so
okay.
We're still in the Easter
all right.
Season.
Okay, all right. And your website, by the way, Neil, W. McCabe, McCabe.com. Do I have
correct.
That right?
Yeah.
Okay. Neil W. Okay.
And you can sign up for Guns and Patriots at GunsAndPatriots.com.
Oh,
well, which comes out every Tuesday.
That should be written down. Okay. Guns and
A-N-D.
Okay. All right. So I've been watching this whole thing, you know, for the last couple of weeks. Jim Carrey comes out, you know, with this video about, you know, you're a big man with a little bitty gland, and then the smallpenisgunclub.com fires up, and it's you know, pointing at all these various sites, and now there's a Small Penis Gun Club website or Facebook page.
Sure.
And it hit me this morning that Wayne LaPierre, isn't Pierre French for Peter?
Yes.
Wayne LaPierre. It's like, I'm starting to get the, you know, is it possible that all these guys who like to strut around with AR-15s or AK-47s, particularly at groups like, you know, the women, Mothers Against Gun Violence, you know,
sure.
That they're compensating for something.
This is a phallic compensation.
That's my theory. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you have an academic background in these things.
No, not really. Well, I mean, arguably.
Yeah, arguably
credentialed, but
the Well, first of all, I want to say about the video. Mm. I thoroughly enjoyed the video as art. I thought it was a brilliant homage to the Hee Haw show, which I love, down to the camera angles and the jokes. I mean,
they did a great job of
as satire or parody. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant. The shot for shot, just like Hee Haw.
Yeah.
But I thought the suggestion that you have that you want to have a gun to compensate for your phallic deficiencies, I thought was really shocking, and it sort of
might it not be true though.
Well, of course it could be true. I mean, a lot of things could be true, but I don't think it is. I think that really people just want to defend themselves. I mean, I think people have guns because they want to be safe and they want to protect themselves and their family.
This prosecuting attorney who was murdered in Texas a couple of days ago, apparently increasingly is looking like some white supremacist group.
Tied to a Mexican meth network.
May well be.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, whatever it is. He had had police protection for a while because one of his assistants had been murdered some time back. And then he said, well, you know, I was in the military. I'm trained. I was a commando. I have a weapon at home. I'm fine.
Right.
Guy had a gun.
Sure.
He was killed on his way into his bedroom where the gun was. It's like, what, you know, and I don't know if his gun was, you know, an AR-40, an AR-15,
yeah, maybe,
you know, with a 30-round clip.
Maybe it was locked to protect the children.
Yeah, or whether
he says he's running to it.
Right, exactly. And so this I have a gun for protection argument. I mean, here's the guy who really has a gun, and they took him out. At what point does this become just kind of a silly argument?
Well, I think just because there's a sliver of a chance that you don't survive. I mean,
more people commit suicide with guns than defend themselves with guns. More people are accidentally killed with guns than defend themselves with guns. The anecdotes of
woman
stops man as he climbs in window of bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, they're so rare that when they happen, they make the front page of Drudge.
Yeah, but, you know, still, I would like that granny to have a chance. Like, just because it only happens once every 100 days doesn't mean I want granny to be defenseless. Like, we don't have an obligation to be victims.
Well, I'm not suggesting granny should be defenseless. My take on this is that, I think this is the old-fashioned Barry Goldwater conservative take, is individual responsibility.
Sure.
If you are going to handle a weapon which is capable of killing people, and I'm familiar with these things.
Okay.
I'm a target shooter. I shoot skeet. I've done competitive target shooting. My brother's very into this stuff. I know how to handle these weapons, some of them. And if you're the guy next to me on the gun range, I don't want to be next to a guy on the gun range. I don't want to make it you, Neil.
No, I don't want
the guy next to me on the gun range there because he thinks it's fun. He's just, hey, let's try this. Hey, give me one. Let me blow it up.
Remember, I'm a guy who deployed to Iraq as the combat historian, where I actually went on one convoy where they actually took my M16 away from me.
Right.
And they said, we're going to hold on to this until the end of this trip, historian. So,
right.
I mean.
Right, because you're not a combat guy.
But you're going to find that there's nowhere is safety giving greater emphasis than the private gun community. You go to a rod and gun club and you behave like a jackass, they're going to call you on it.
Absolutely.
And there's no government regulation that says it. It's the culture that's stronger law.
I don't disagree. And in fact, you know, my early firearms training was with the NRA and at the Georgia Police Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm familiar with that. But what I'm saying is let's make that so. Right. So let's just say, you know, with cars, we had cars. We didn't regulate cars in the United States for the first 25, 30 years. We had cars from the 1890s until the 1920s. There were no regulations on cars. And then they started going fast enough and there started being enough of them that they started running people over and people got in accidents and collisions. And we said, we've got to do something about this. Make it rational. OK, so first of all, we came up with the rules for the road. We've already done that with guns. I mean, if you're a hunter and you know about duck plugs, I mean, you know, there are limits on what you can do to be an appropriate sportsman. But the other thing we did with cars was we said, let's register them from manufacture to destruction.
Right.
So that there's a chain of ownership, which can be defined. Let's have people prove their proficiency with a driver's license. They can demonstrate that they know what it is and how to use it because it's capable of killing people.
Absolutely.
And let's have a minimum level of insurance, that being liability insurance, so that if that car is even stolen or if it's misused or accidentally hurts somebody, I mean,
The society is not on the hook.
I find it mind-boggling that those 20 kids in Newtown who are all dead now, that their families didn't even get burial money out of this thing. If whatever that kid's name was, if he had been driving a car, even intending to kill these kids, if he had been driving a car, Geico would be paying out $1 million to each one of these families. But because they were killed with guns, they get nothing.
Well, I don't know if there may have been a liability policy that Lanza had, or maybe his family had.
To the best of my knowledge, there was not.
And if there's an estate, one could suggest that there would be civil remedies available that just haven't been explored yet.
There may be, and we'll see how that goes.
And so that process is in place.
But that shouldn't be necessary. $25 a year. Liability insurance for a gun owner is not that much.
I can agree with you, for all of these things. The problem is that if it runs afoul of what's enshrined in the Second Amendment,
the Second Amendment was ratified 2 years after the Constitution was.
If you want to make that case, go ahead and then go through the constitutional process that's available to everyone.
Article 1, Section 8, Sentence 7, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay for post offices and postal roads.
Yes.
So roads, the right to have a road and use that road was in the Constitution before guns were in the Constitution.
Right.
So, and we say it's a limited right, just like the right of free speech is. There are certain words we can't say on the radio here. There are things you can't yell in a crowded theater.
Yeah, but you're hard-pressed to avoid a word like shall not be infringed. I mean, that's pretty clear. And so if you want to change that.
But we have infringed on it.
Well,
you can't have a 50 caliber machine gun.
Then maybe that should be challenged.
So you think that people should be able to have shoulder-fired surface-to-air rocket launchers?
No, there's never been a spree shooter that's ever used one of those.
That's because they're not available.
Well, I mean, I would trust people with
it. I think that there have been spree shooters in Afghanistan and Iraq that have used those.
I think that
that's why those planes spiral down when you come into the Baghdad airport.
I've corkscrewed, and there are no windows in the C-130, so we have no idea when it's going to stop or when it's going to end.
Right.
But I think
Neil, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
All right,
we'll continue to debate this. Neil McCabe, hang on just a second, Neil. I want your website one more time.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It is gunsandpatriots.com?
Correct.
Gunsandpatriots.com.
Yes, and a very robust Facebook page.
Okay, great. Neil McCabe. Thank you, Neil. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gary in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I listen to you and the teacher. You know, you guys are sort of patting yourselves on the back, how open-minded and everything, but seems to me the left is more vicious and more reluctant to hear the opposition opinion. And
vicious.
I could bring up.
How is the left vicious?
I was listening to the Steph show earlier, and right away they start, screwing redneck.
Gary, you're not. That's not the show you're listening to right now, and I can't speak for another show. But I don't think
Even with the gun guy, you guys are
sure.
Just arguing back and forth. It's like the point of you conversing with him is you believe different things. Did anything he say make sense to you? Did anything you say make sense to him?
I think so.
I think
Neil and I actually have some areas where we're pretty close in opinion. And Neil, by the way, is a friend. I mean, he's as conservative as they come, and he's a decent man.
But I try talking to people left, and I agree some things left, some things right. One thing I don't agree with is Obamacare. And if I bring up something simple like, okay, the person who passed this law, Obama and Pelosi and Reid, they exempted themselves from it. You know, if that was Bush passing some major overhaul, and he, at the same time, telling you it's great for you, but I'm exempting myself from it, just be honest and say that's bull, that he passes law for everyone, and then he exempts himself and exempts herself.
Gary, if that was true, I would share your outrage. But members of Congress, they basically right now buy their insurance from a pool, and it will be under the Obamacare pool eventually. Maybe I don't know how. I think the president has his own doctor, and that's been going on
in the private sector. Now, for companies we work with, and if you have to buy your own insurance, stuff like that. Literally, since this bill is passed, and I can send you statements if you don't believe me. My health care coverage has doubled.
Oh, the health insurance companies are robbing us blind, Gary. These guys are making so much profit. You know, Stephen J. Hemsley, the guy who's the CEO of United Healthcare, has taken over $1 billion in compensation. He's got 100 people making over $1 million.
Got to change.
They
it's
are
got to change. Either just go all for the single payer, or totally revamp, you know, the private healthcare system. Or how about this?
I'm with you.
I have family. I have a family member who's a genius. He's a structural engineer. He could have been a doctor. He had the brain. He didn't have the money. Right. I would be so for public money to get more and more doctors, more and more hospitals, more and more whatever. And I think that would lessen the cost, because then they would have some competition. They couldn't just charge you whatever you want.
Well, that's how it is in every other country in the world. We pay about twice as much as any other country in the world for health care, and we're 27th in the world in terms of outcomes.
But my point is, conservatives are nervous that there will be a doctor shortage. That's their big complaint. Instead of just calling them a hillbilly or saying redneck about that, you know, let's hear their complaint and match it and just say, well, what we're going to do so there won't be a doctor shortage is we're going to pay for these kids that are going to be engineers or other degrees where they have the brain.
I'm with you, Gary. I'm with you. In fact, I'd like to take it a step farther, and because I'm a big believer in individual responsibility. It was my whole point about why I think that, you know, gun owners should register their guns and get, you know, just basic insurance and show proficiency. I also think that we should make a deal with our young people. That's our intellectual infrastructure. That's the future of this nation, as you correctly pointed out. And I think the deal should be this. And this is how Germany did it in the 80s when I lived there. I don't know if they still do. I know a lot of European countries do. If you will serve your country for a year, and it need not be in the military, although that would be the first option that would be presented to you. But if you are a conscientious objector, you don't want to go into the military, then you could do that year's service in a hospital or in a school or some other appropriate place where you're helping out some nonprofit organization, homeless shelter, whatever. If you will serve your country for a year, then we will give you a college education all the way up to MD or PhD at no cost. And
it would cost the taxpayers less in the end, I guarantee it.
You're absolutely right, and the GI Bill is the proof of that. You know, the money that we spent on the GI Bill, we made back 16 to 17 times in tax revenue over the life of the people who took the GI Bill. Additional tax revenue.
Thanks for hearing me out. And I just think healthcare, we need to talk more about it. It's just out of control. Obamacare didn't solve it. It just confused it, in my opinion. And, you know, just for the friends on the left, just to let you know.
Okay.
You know, I grew up in Louisiana, and it's just sensitive when people just say redneck just to be snarky or just to make an easy, you know, an easy point on an argument. Because you go to a trailer park or redneck park, you know, whatever you want to call it,
right,
down south, it's a sad situation. You know, you got little kids running around holding their only teddy bear, and
criminals
living amongst them. It's sad. It's as sad as going to an urban, black, poor community that
poverty is terrible wherever it is.
The last thing they need is to be called names and to be viciously attacked, and they should be defended too. And a lot of them are, you know, Democrats, by the way. People don't talk about it, but they are. They have to vote that way to get some support. So let's just remember we're all together and just be a little bit nicer to each other. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gary. And thanks for listening to WCPT in Chicago. Oh, 24 seconds? Oh, I'm sorry. You're off by a minute. Okay, cool. So you have a minute and a half. Marty in Denver, listening to 760 AM. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hello. Hi, Tom. I'm sorry. I almost lost my train of thought here. You were talking about Grayson Ouspensky and all, which I didn't even try to read Beelzebub's Tales to His Son and stuff. It was a very, very confusing 35, 40 pages that I got through on it.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Same here.
I was kind of going on that line of thought, but if I may digress, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
Just in general.
Well, we have a half a minute.
Okay.
It's all yours.
Just to are we our politics or are politics us? And I generally think that, you know, for me personally, I'm not my politics, because I do have some very conservative views, but I'm going to give you the $64,000 question here that you might expound on and tell me maybe where I can read about some, you know, some opinions like this. Why is it that here in the United States we don't look at, you know, the systems that are running countries in Scandinavia in particular? And I traveled a couple of years throughout Europe and spent some time in Scandinavia. It seems like there's almost a perfect marriage between capitalism and socialism.
Yes, it's called democratic socialism. And it's how the Nordic states are all run, and it works quite well, thank you very much. And I think it's not talked about in the United States anywhere near enough. I agree with you, Marty. And I think that the main reason it's not is because there's a bunch of greedy capitalists in this country who would rather you didn't know about it because it involves regulating capitalism. Marty, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, this is interesting. Joe in Minneapolis has a very, very interesting take on registering guns and registering the votes. The good, the bad, and the very, very lamaciously ugly, the good. Judge Sarah Evans Barker. On Friday, Barker, the head judge for the U.S. District Court for Southern Indiana, declared unconstitutional a law that allowed Indiana police officers to search suspected immigrants without a warrant. The law also allowed police officers to take into custody any immigrants possessing certain kinds of immigration papers. According to Think Progress, the stipulation created a bizarre loophole in which a police officer could arrest an individual holding the paperwork necessary to obtain legal immigration status. Not surprisingly, given the evidence, Judge Barker struck down the 2011 law, citing its gross violation of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable search and seizure. Good work, Judge Barker. The bad. Tennessee State Legislature. Late last week, volunteer state lawmakers... Oh, it's the volunteer state, not volunteering state lawmakers. Voiced their approval for a bill that, if passed, would tie welfare benefits to student academic performance. The proposal, sponsored by two Republicans, will cut welfare checks by 30% for those families whose children don't perform to the state's standard. The bill was proposed in January, and after moving through committee this weekend, will now face a vote in the state's Senate. Tennessee law already mandates a 20% cut in benefits to the families of students with poor attendance records, and the state's welfare program only provides a meager $185 a month to its participants. Nevertheless, the state's Health and Human Services Department has withdrawn its opposition to the bill, and lawmakers hope that it will serve as a carrot-and-stick approach for needy families. Right. Because what a struggling mom needs is the added stress of having to worry about whether or not her third grader's geography grade will be good enough that she can buy groceries for the week. And the very, very ugly, the New York Police Department. According to new testimony in the ongoing trial of the NYPD's Stop and Frisk program, Police Chief Raymond Kelly designed the program to terrify the city's minority communities. The testimony provided by State Senator Eric Adams says that back in 2010, Commissioner Kelly told New York officials that he wanted the Stop and Frisk to instill in fear in them, the city's black and Latino population, that any time they could leave their homes, they could be targeted by police. End of quote. For years, Kelly and other law enforcement officials have defended Stop and Frisk as an unpleasant, yet necessary public safety measure. Civil liberties organizations, on the other hand, have condemned the policy as discriminatory and intrusive. But if Eric Adams' testimony is true, we now know that the real reason for Stop and Frisk is even worse than just bad policy. It's about trying to terrify an entire population into submission. And that is very, very ugly. Very, very ugly. Joe, listening to KTNF in Minneapolis. Hey, Joe, you have some thoughts on gun registration?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just also want to quickly say I wish I could be as half as smart as you are here. The quickly thing is that the gun groups don't believe, since it's in the Constitution, that you shouldn't have to register a gun. You shouldn't have to register that you own guns. You shouldn't have to register that you even purchased a gun.
Right.
And we know that voting is a right in the Constitution as well. So why do I have to register to vote?
Ooh, touche. Yes. Absolutely. We regulate the... Of course. Boy, you just gave me the best argument. Joe, thank you. Thank you so much for that. That's a book.
Sure.
Hang on just a second, Joe. I'm going to put you on hold here. You are the guy who Shane is going, book, give that guy a book. Joe is on line two, Danielle, and we're going to send you an autographed copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How We Can Fight Back, or How You Can Fight Back. Autographed by the author, that would be me. So thank you, Joe. Congratulations. Alfredo in Mountain View, California. Hey, Alfredo, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, Tom, I am of the opinion that the Second Amendment should be amended and get rid of guns. I mean, most people of the majority of people don't want guns in this country. Why should we have to allow the NRA or a small special interest group to shove down our throats their views?
Yeah.
We don't want guns in this country.
I would say that it's not so much that the Second Amendment needs to be regulated, but that we need to either stop the Supreme Court from claiming the power to decide what the Constitution means, and Congress should affirmatively assert that they're the ones who have that power, at least when it comes to laws made under the Constitution. And then let's go back to the Second Amendment and actually read it, because it says a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. So what it is saying is, in my opinion, and the Supreme Court's opinion up until 4 or 5 years ago, is that the right to own a gun is contingent on your right to be a member of a militia. And we have these state militias. They're called the National Guard now. And frankly, I think that it would be a better thing for us to have state militias than to have a federal army. I'm with Thomas Jefferson on that. But let's appropriately and correctly interpret the Second Amendment and say, you know, if you're not a member of a militia, you don't have a right to bear a gun. You have the privilege of bearing a gun in this country, and to fulfill that privilege, you know, here are some just basic standards, like, you know, demonstrate that you're not a crazy person, demonstrate that you haven't committed, you know, violent assaults against people in the past, you know, basically pass a background check. So, but Alfredo, I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Excellent point. Kevin in Albany, New York. Hey, Kevin, you don't like the idea of insurance for guns?
Oh, actually, I would love it if it existed. But I own an insurance agency for 20 years, mm-hmm. Sold it 10 years ago, and I've been working as an insurance adjuster. I'm licensed in several states. And your argument that gun insurance would be like car insurance has a serious flaw in it that I wanted to bring to your attention.
Okay.
That is, every insurance company, and we love these insurance carriers, has this magical thing called exclusions. And virtually every insurance policy that's out there excludes a couple of things. Number one, it excludes intentional acts. So let me give an example. I had a client many years ago that drove off a bridge trying to kill himself and destroyed his brand new car. Okay. After he got out of the hospital and got himself together, I had the unfortunate duty of saying, gee, I'm really sorry, the insurance isn't going to cover you because it was an intentional act. So now, are you not only depressed, now you've got a car payment for a car you don't have anymore.
Right.
But,
ouch.
But the bottom line is that if I take my car and I try to kill somebody with that car, my insurance is not going to indemnify the person I tried to kill because my intentional act voids the insurance policy.
Right. Makes sense.
Now, the other thing that's really important is that when somebody buys car insurance, they're really not insuring the car. They're insuring the owner of the car.
Right.
Now, this becomes really important because what happens is if somebody steals my car out of the driveway and goes and kills 18 people with that car, my insurance company does not pay for those 18 people because I didn't do anything negligent. It might pay for the damage to my car to indemnify me because I'm the insured, not the car.
Oh, that's interesting. So, I didn't realize that. So,
so
if a car is stolen, where is the liability? With the car thief, presumably?
Yes. And here in New York State, we have a thing called the Crime Victims Compensation Board that may have money and may not, depending upon the budget, that would be able to indemnify somebody who was the victim of a crime, i.e. stealing my car and hurting them.
I see. So what you're suggesting is that given the current way that insurance companies have structured insurance policies and all this kind of thing, that the gun insurance, gun owners' liability insurance, essentially, that I've been talking about, that would have paid these kids for Adam Lanza's murdering them in Newtown, does not exist, and in fact probably would not exist. I wonder, though, if a third of American households have a gun in them, and if there's more guns out there in the United States than there are Americans, and I think that those statistics are right, then, and you made insurance mandatory. I mean, you know, car insurance companies make money on car insurance because it's mandatory. Wouldn't insurance companies step up and say, "Hey, we'll write the policy"?
They'll write the policy, but here's the thing: what a policy! Like, you take a guy like Dick Cheney who shot his friend in the face.
Right.
His Dick Cheney's homeowner's policy would indemnify the guy he shot because Dick accidentally shot him.
Right.
But if somebody stole Dick Cheney's gun and killed somebody, there's no liability to indemnify.
Right. Well, maybe we could, you know, as part of the law that, that puts that insurance into place, we could create a national victims pool for...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I agree. That'd be great because as much as I love the concept of insuring guns, there is not, you know, insurance companies, they're all about making money. They're not about protecting people.
Right, but on the other hand, they also will operate, they will write the policies within the boundaries of the regulations that are defined by the states.
Yes, but what happens is what they makes an insurance company really nervous is the actuarial risk.
Right.
And the bottom line is if an insurance company is insuring me, they know that I'm a regular guy, I go to work every day, I own a home,
right,
yada, yada, yada. But if some guy who steals my gun, that's a homeowner scenario.
Right. It would be interesting to have, you know, an actuary, to run the numbers on gun insurance. Because it might even turn out to be like with nuclear power plant insurance. There is no insurance company in the world that will write a policy for a nuclear power plant, which is why we have the Price-Anderson Act. We insure them because they're so dangerous. Kevin, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Every day in every way, I am learning more. What was the old French philosopher? I am getting better every day in every way. Yeah. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you and Rob in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's up?
I tried to talk to you a couple seconds ago. For some strange reason, I got cut off. But anyway, I got a thought, and I just want you to run with it.
Mm-hmm.
Under Citizens United, corporations are considered people, correct?
Well, sort of, yeah.
Okay, but anyway, it's where if a foreign corporation comes to the United States and doesn't apply for citizenship, and aren't they here illegally and should apply to the immigration policy?
So we should put the foreign corporations like what is it, SBC Bank or HSBC Bank, whatever it is that was.
I mean, there's a lot of other things out there. It's where
give them to ICE.
Get through.
Yeah, put them. You know, send them to ICE. There you go. Good one, Rob. Thank you for that. The absurdity of Citizens United is so easy to demonstrate. It's mind-boggling. Randy, listening on WWRL in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, Randy?
It's a pleasure speaking to you. A long-time listener, but first-time caller, though.
Well, thank you, Randy.
Right. My understanding is the reason most of those people are refuting the Obamacare because it's the money that they make of the condition, you know, the present condition.
I don't understand. The reason the people are refusing, you mean the reason the governors and states are refusing to take Medicaid money? Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You said something very, very smart before. I mean, medicine or the medical studies in this country should have been something social.
Yes.
People should be allowed to go to school, learn medicine, and give it back to the community thereafter.
Yes.
It's not what's going on. They invest so much money into medical school. By the time they finish, they went on a rack.
Yeah. They got their $200,000 in debt coming out of medical school and 30 years old. And then, you know, it's like they've got to figure out a way to you know, put the hustle on. And then on top of that, you got for-profit corporations running the hospitals. And Shana was telling me that the stock market hit an all-time high today. And in part, it was powered by the fact that the health insurance companies saw a 4 to 6% increase in their stock prices because they're getting ready to screw all of us even more And they're going to try and they've figured out that they can blame it on Obamacare, because the Republican governors in the southern states are using, not all southern states, but the Republican governors in these states are refusing to take the Medicaid money, and therefore it's shrinking the pool of plans that will be offered, and therefore the health insurance will be a little bit more expensive for people for a year. And so Obama had to postpone this for a year, and this was all because of a Supreme Court decision that said that that part of Obamacare violated the 10th Amendment, which is crazy. But I'm with you, Randy. I'm absolutely with you. This should be socialized. Thank you for the call. Tony in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm just riding down the interstate. Now, I called earlier. The lady was talking about the country being founded on religion and and God and all. You tell I'm from the South. I go to a small church out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
If people come in our church talking politics, they get asked to leave. You're supposed to go to church, go to church. You're supposed to talk politics. That's the reason there's separation of church and state.
Well, good on you and on your church. It's that's good
well,
to
that's
hear.
The way all the small countries, the small country Baptist churches all over these mountains.
Yeah.
That's the way they are. You don't talk politics in church. That's for Monday through Saturday.
Great.
And anyway, the guy that said that liberals, Democrats were hateful talking, it's not that. It's just they get their feathers ruffled when they're talking their politics. You say, well, what about Social Security and Medicare? Why don't we put it over here by themselves where they're supposed to be, and then figure out what was taken out of them out of general fund for the last 30 years and pay it back with a 1.5% interest over prime? That way they're not going to go broke. Why don't you give the people back what you took from them?
Yeah.
They get their feathers ruffled.
Yeah, they do, especially the Wall Street guys, you know, the Pete Petersons and whatnot. Yeah, they seriously get their feathers ruffled. Tony, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Michael in Garner, North Carolina. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Let me preface what I'm saying by saying, man, I love you because I appreciate the way you bring people that are informed and you debate them. You're fearless in standing up and doing it that way. I really disagree with you, except when you talk about religion sometimes.
Okay.
But I have to go with against you on the gun control because, and what you said about your interpretation of the Second Amendment kind of ties into it. I read, lawyers from the period discuss what the Second Amendment meant. I can send that to you, your email, where they plainly talk about how the aristocracy would take weapons off our arms away from the populace so that they had control of them, wouldn't allow them to hunt and those types of things, even in England. I think that even though we feel pretty secure here in this country, that all you got to do is look at the next country across the water and see where the governments oppress people. And maybe it seems far-fetched now in this day and time, but 50 years from now or 80 years from now, our country could be oppressed, and I think having an armed citizenry helps to stop that. By the way, I'm a Democrat. I voted a straight Democratic.
That's all fine, Michael. Here's where I disagree. I think having an informed citizenry is what stops tyranny, not an armed citizenry. And that's why, you know, so many of the founders, particularly Jefferson, were so aggressive about public education. It's why he started the University of Virginia as a free school. But the whole gun Second Amendment thing, well, we're out of time. So, Michael, thank you for the call. We'll leave it with your thoughts. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and information from Wall Street, Main Street, and everywhere in between. And Dr. Mike Newcomb is going to be filling in for me. I'm boogieing out. He'll tell you all about it. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. We'll be back tomorrow. The program will be back.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.